The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by LawPods.
Well, we're here today with Steve DeBosier and Chad Dudley of the famous Dudley DeBosier firm in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Steve and Chad and I just recently got acquainted. I was in Costa Rica with Chad and their other partner, James, in January. I got to spend a little time with them. And then I got to go to the world headquarters of Dudley DeBosier in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And so that, of course, was a thrill to walk into such a prestigious place, this little house that it was a converted house, right? That's what that one I was at was one of your locations.
No.
Or was it a building?
It was a building.
That was a building.
Yeah. Unless if it was a if somebody has 10,000 square foot houses, we're back in California, you know?
It's true. So it's just a building. That's right. I got a bad memory and I get confused easily. So you just keep me on track. But anyways, Steven's been on our podcast before, but Chad has not. And Chad is more of a business guru these days, from my understanding, than he is a trial lawyer. He leaves that to Steve and his team over there. Chad's in Nashville most of the time, running the operations of Dudley DeBosier, an accelerator, and CJ Advertising. Did I get that right, Chad?
That's correct, yeah. Split my time between that and Nashville.
All right, but you weren't always a businessman. Yeah, one time you were an actual practicing lawyer. But just to give us a little backstory, when did you decide or how did you know that you wanted to become a lawyer?
Well, you know, background, grew up playing tennis, with a lot of attorneys, some pretty cool people. I thought they were pretty nicely supported me and helping travel to tournaments and all that kind of stuff. When I finished undergrad, I played tennis for LSU. I taught tennis for 2 years. And if you haven't been to Louisiana, it's really hot here in the summer. And I decided, you know what, if I can just find an air conditioning job, that I think life would be good. And so I like to read, I like to write, went to law school. That's how it happened. It happened that quick. It wasn't like some plan when I was 12 years old, I want to be an attorney. I just decided later on in life. And then, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah, but Dan, let me interrupt that a little, just a tad bit. He would not tell me as he played tennis in Hawaii and was brought out to, which is now IMG Academy, Balotelli Academy. Then he played for LSU, and now with the most doubles victory ever at LSU, they have a number one tennis court named after Chad Dudley at Louisiana State University. So he's not giving that full credit. He's trying to, you know, be humble, which I've been told I could be more of.
We got the wrong posse here. And in case anybody doesn't know, Chad is also a very, 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 very good pickleball player, because I consider myself to be a little bit of a pickle player. But it's not really fun to play with Chad because there is no ball that he doesn't get. And he smashes it. It's not really that fun. It's like whoever he can have a person with one leg on his team, and he's most likely going to beat you. But I did beat him one game. It was really thrilling that we were up like 8-3 in the next game and feeling confident. But we got slammed down quickly as soon as Chad decided to step it up. But let me ask you this, though. This whole being a college athlete, Division I-A and stuff, how do you think that experience helped you to become better at trial lawyering / business? Because you spent a lot of time on the tennis court.
I think trial lawyers are competitive by nature and they want to win, they want to fight. And so coming from a background like that, I think that's just how you're wired. And when you get out, you want to be the best at what you do. You want to train to be the best. You want to have the discipline to be the best. And you bring a lot of those characteristics over into whatever you do. And I went into the field of being an attorney and representing plaintiffs. And so I took that same competitive spirit, that same work ethic, that same discipline, and applied it to the practice of law. And that's what resonated with my partners, is that they're extremely competitive. And when they represent somebody, it's on and it's a battle. And that's why we mesh together so well, is that when we got together, we said, we don't want to create a mediocre law firm. We don't even want to create just a good law firm. We want to build a great, great firm.
Not the greatest firm in Louisiana or the United States, but the greatest law firm in the world is what we're going to build here.
I think when we get in, this is something that we're very intentional about, is like, we want to push ourselves, we want to compete against ourselves. Look, we're on things like this. We do things like this. We're going to go teach at the university. We're an open book. We think by making other law firms great, it helps all of our clients. It helps our industry. And so we have firms, we have competitors come over and check out our operation where we share forms with them, we share processes with them. But our goal is what we control our firm. How good can we make ourselves? We're competing against ourselves because that's what we can control.
Right. And so after you go through law school, you get your bar card. Tell us about, from getting your bar card to...
Yeah, so straight out the gates, I won't get too much, but I decided, I want to work on the plaintiff side. And straight out of the gates, I worked for a plaintiff's firm that handled mass torts. My first case was a case where 4,000 plaintiffs were exposed to creosote, to a chemical near a railroad facility. And I was in charge of discovery, which was about as glamorous as it sounds. If you're ever in the spot where you're answer discovery and do fact sheets for 4,000 people, it's a challenge. And in order to keep track of it all, I learned some database programming and some software building skills, and combined, in law school with some tech, and that led to when I changed jobs and worked for a smaller firm, I applied some of the tech concepts I had learned representing thousands of plaintiffs to that. And then that led to an opportunity where I met Steve and James. We all worked at a firm where I was still handling cases, but starting to split my time between that and the operational side, solving stuff, building systems and processes. And then at the time, still handling a few cases.
So you guys started your firm in what year?
2009. We started in 2009.
Oh, so your 15th birthday. You guys are rowdy.
Coming up soon. June.
It'll be our 15 years.
Can we have a 15-year birthday party anniversary for you out there in Huntington Beach?
As long as we don't have to pay the bar tab, we're all in for the party.
We'll give you guys the food. People don't really eat. They just drink, so it's cool. So you guys have been together doing this for 15 years. And so you learned a lot during those 15 years. And Chad, you've been the operations guy for all 15 years. I mean, did you sit right into that role?
When we're talking to firms and they're trying to create their ideal firm, one of the things that we say over and over again is that the firm you're trying to create, the firm you want to create, is going to be built on your strengths, not on your weaknesses. It's not going to be built because you took your weakest thing that you're not good at and don't like doing and became better at it. It's because the things that you're naturally good at and enjoy doing and create better results for your clients. So you got better and better at those things. And early on, Steve, James, and I said, what are each other's strengths? And can we allow each other the ability to just worry about those things? It doesn't mean that we don't cross over at times, but primarily each of us said, Steve and James are incredibly talented trial attorneys, and that's what they love doing. I leaned more towards the operations side. And so while we kind of blended in the beginning, early on, we said, Chad, you focus on operations. Steve, James, you focus on handling our best cases and getting great results. And that was probably one of the smarter moves that we made somewhat intuitively early on. And that's how we kind of got into our different areas.
And the terminology we use, Dan, is that Chad is the science behind the law and James and I are the art behind the law. Because if I were left with the devices of doing what Chad does so well at, if I had to do all that, we would be referred to as the law firm that used to be called Dudley DeBossier. But we're not, because Chad does it and he's awesome at it.
Right. And out of all the firms I come across, very few that I've seen have a separation between the business operations and, the trial in the partnership sequence, because many people that are great trial lawyers will hire somebody to be their ops person, but it's not quite the same as having, a partner who's got the business sense be the ops person. I mean, I think Claggett has that going over at his firm too with his partner. And it's a really solid thing because you need a great trial lawyer, you need somebody running the business and doing the marketing and handling all the people, and not too many great trial lawyers really have the bandwidth to deal with the rest of that.
And, I would not be able to do what I do if I had to worry about, how are we going to get great results on our best cases? And so the reason it really works well is that we really, if people sit in on our meetings, we want them to feel uncomfortable about how comfortable we are with each other. And what I mean by that is we fight, we challenge the best ideas. We're like, okay, can this be systematized? Can it not be? How do we get to what's in the best interest of the client? And everything that we do, how do we end up with that result? And we get after it. And so we're dedicated to that. And we argue for that in different ways.
And so before we get into what you're going to be jointly teaching for 2 days in this business optimization operations masterclass, I want to ask you a little bit more about your background, because you not only run, the operations of Dudley DeBossier, but you also have a couple other projects, and I want to ask you about those one at a time. One is your accelerator. What is Accelerator?
Accelerator is, so back in 2018, Steve, James, and myself, we purchased CJ Advertising, and they had done our firm's advertising for a chunk of time, and the owner wanted to exit. And we said, you know what? What if we bought it? And we bought it, and CJ Advertising does advertising for maybe about 60 to 65 law firms all across the country. And we decided to approach it from a little bit different standpoint. I'd been doing consulting for about 9 years at that point. And I said, what if we not only, you know, help firms generate cases, but what if we bring all the stuff that we've learned through building firms, through consulting, what if we bring that over to CJ Advertising? And we did. We just tried to help the firms grow in addition to getting them cases. And then at some point, we decided, you know what, there's a lot of advertising agencies kind of went down that path. Like back in the day, there's no operational component to any advertising agency. And after we started doing this, all of a sudden, you know, almost every advertising agency now has some operational component. We wanted to brand it. We've been doing this for, you know, 15 years, but we wanted to brand it a little bit differently. And that's how Accelerator was born, saying, okay, this is the operational consulting piece of CJ Advertising. And it gives us a chance to work with just different firms, not only in the CJ family, but across the country.
And it's allowed us access to get to law firms where they have great lawyers, either great partners, but they're not operationally sound. And I don't mean that to disparaging body, but great lawyers don't want to be screwing around with the operational stuff. And so they get us in there and we can do the operational stuff behind the scenes. And then the ones that don't have great lawyers, we can help them on that side as well. Right now, I mean, James is in trial this week. I was supposed to be in trial this week. We have another trial going on in Shreveport, Louisiana. So we can go in there and help them with the operational part of it and then the legal side of it as well.
Yeah, that helps. I mean, obviously, you got to have both sides clicking to be having fun and making money, because if you're not making money, it's really not that much fun. I know that a lot because I spent a lot of years as a young lawyer, especially working for myself, not making any money, having a miserable life, having an idiot for a boss and named Dan, of course, so who's crazy, can run in 50 directions at once. Not a good way to run things. So the accelerator is you both consult with other law firms, but you also have a conference once or twice a year. And is that right?
Yeah. Yes, we do. And what we've done is one to help firms just from the operational components. But then in addition to that, you know, we've been very meticulous about how do we continue to get better results for our clients? How do we systematically get, you know, improve the results for our clients? And we started sharing what worked for us with other law firms at CJ and again, across the country, and then seeing similar results to things that we got in other firms. And it's kind of fun. I mean, you know, things that were born in our boardroom, round tabling, thinking of, hey, what if we did this? What if we did this? And then seeing, you know, 10 years later, almost common practice for so many firms that do what we do and using those tools. And it's pretty wild. It's pretty cool. But we share those things. We're open book. We believe that if we make other law firms better, that's one way for serving plaintiffs, serving the clients that we're, you know, sworn to represent. And the conferences are a way to share that. We'll share exactly the 10 things that we've done in the past to increase our average closed fee, how we implement them down to the details and what order we implement them. And that's what those conferences are for. They've been well received and we get a good group at each one.
And so your next one's in Nashville in September. Is that right?
That is correct.
Because he doesn't want to be in Nashville in September, Dan.
Is it nice there in September? Because I know I'm going there for AHA in July, and I heard it's bloody hot, like Vegas hot and humid.
Yeah, you got to get toward the end of September, toward October. And if you like music, not just country music, just any kind of music. And it also happens to be the bachelorette capital of the world. So
Vegas.
If you got any bachelorettes listening.
Just in case, let them know they can go there before they get married. Perfect for the bachelorettes. But you said,
September 26th, Nashville coming out.
All right. But you also said that you were a consultant for 9 years before you started that. And so where were you doing that consulting?
So in 2009, we started Dudley DeBossier. And then that same year started Vista Consulting with Tim Mackey, who's a dear friend. Good stuff. And I had gotten out of Vista Consulting in 2018 when we bought CJ Advertising, just was focusing on, you know, CJ clients. And gosh, over the years, probably have worked with over 200 personal injury law firms across the country, from solo practitioners to massive multi-state juggernauts and everything in between.
All right. So now we're going to talk about Huntington Beach, because before we talk about Huntington Beach, First, I will let you know that when you get there on Tuesday, it's going to start off with a little pool and cabana, social. And then that evening, we're going to have a pregame in the presidential suite because we want to make sure you guys have a good welcome because it's your first TLU event and create a positive impression there in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Just letting you know about that.
Is there going to be any pickleball courts there too?
You know what? Matt was talking about, because Matt got his ass kicked by Chad too, but Matt was talking about organizing a morning pickleball game at like 6:30, find some courts. Because, you know, it was a lot of fun. We were down there in Costa Rica. And this other guy, Ed Ceramboli, he's doing a morning workout on the beach. Because in New York City, he did a morning workout in Central Park. And so now he's going to roll that over. Because he had like 30 people getting together with him every morning going out there. I was like, when I get up early, have coffee, get things going. I was like, bravo, people. Good for your health and fitness. Get the body moving before we work the brain. And it was kind of cool because people get together and, you know, the socializing stuff. But June 5th. 9 a.m. at the start of this conference, since everybody knows you've broken down what you're going to be doing into 12 blocks, you know, 6 one-hour blocks each day, because each day is, you know, 6 hours of teaching each day. And so that way people can understand exactly what they're getting if they go to the TLUbeach.com website. But when you start off the first hour of your program in Huntington Beach, what are people going to get in hour number one from Dudley DeBosier team?
Well, in hour number one, I mean, Steve and I always ask, like, okay, what kind of firm are you trying to build? You know, are you trying to be like a firm that handles a low number of cases, but bigger cases or potentially bigger cases? Okay, that's a different model. It's a different strategy. Or are you trying to create, you know, a multi-city or multi-state practice? And that's a different strategy. And then, okay, what assets do you currently have? If you're trying to build a trial firm, but you got a bunch of young trial attorneys with not much experience, hit some challenges there. There's a bunch of different ways to build a great law firm. We've seen people do it a number of different ways, asking what law firm or what kind of law firm is right for you and what assets do you have to get there. And so the beginning hour is just asking some of those questions, because if you don't know the answers to those questions, if you don't know where you're going or what you're trying to aim for, it's tough to hit the target.
Okay. So after you put that question to people and they decide, okay, this is the kind of law firm I want, now, where do we go from there? Once they decide who they want to be.
So I say, you know, look, first tell us where you want to go. What are you trying to create? What are you trying to build? The next thing is you got to know where you currently are and do an honest assessment. And like I mentioned, some of the things, how healthy is your firm right now? Where your case is currently coming from? What kind of attorneys do you have? Do you have a bunch of guys that are all killer trial attorneys that have gotten, you know, a lot of experience in litigation and trial? Okay, you can build a different type of firm with that, those assets. And you got all first year law students that just start from scratch, and we worked with those. That's different, right? And we look at just, okay, take an assessment. How's your intake doing? Okay, what's your cash flow look like? What kind of cases do you have currently? How many of those cases do you have currently? How many cases does each attorney have? Where are they generating fees? And it's a way to say, okay, if you want to build this, that's great. You have to understand where you're starting from and have an honest evaluation of that. Because if you don't do that, it's really tough to create a roadmap to where you want to go.
That's what we found a lot of people. They don't really want to sit down and say, this is the talent of lawyer I have right now, or this is my risk tolerance, you know, in handling cases, or am I willing to forego money to spend on a nice Porsche today so I can buy a nicer one later on? There's some people that just can't do that. And so you have to know where you are and where you want to go before you go down that path.
I think a lot of, if you look at sometimes what you want to build or the type of attorney you want to be, you're like, hey, you know what? I want to go be a great attorney that gets some really big verdicts. I want to improve these skills. It can be daunting when you think of it sometimes in those terms, but at least have a vision of, hey, this is the direction I want to go in. And you just got to chip away. And so every year that we've had the firm, we start, where are we right now? And what do we need to become? What do we need to accomplish to create the firm that we want to create? We knew from day one, because we did this exercise going, look, we want to be a firm that delivers great client service. We're going to be known for that. And then in addition to that, we don't want to be a firm that refers out its big cases. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but we want to be a firm that tries them in-house. And then Steve and James went through, okay, how are we going to build a team of attorneys that are really, really great at doing that? So they're just, and it's cool because you look back and you're like, okay, we've gotten some silly results. Steve and James just tried a case with a few of our other attorneys and got a, you know, $50+ million verdict. And we got some other large verdicts over the years. And that's awesome. And there's, you know, trials going on with other attorneys that Steve and James have worked with that are getting some fantastic results. And we're like, okay, this is awesome. We got there. But it was a bunch of years being disciplined about what are we going to do to get there? Because we knew who we wanted to be as a firm.
And it took discipline. If we look back, and I can say this without sounding, maybe this doesn't sound braggadocious, but we didn't have hardly any verdicts over $1 million for first 5 years of our practice. And now we look at it and it's anywhere from 20 to 30 or plus a year. So that's a big change in 10 years. But that was not a change that occurred in 1 year. It's a change that occurred with constantly pushing that flywheel, pushing the flywheel, pushing the flywheel.
And I just say, I need to add in there, you know, if you're building great trial lawyers, you might consider having them be on TLU On Demand and perhaps attending my boot camp. You don't know that yet, but you shall see. Just suggesting a selfless plug here. But one thing you had on there that I wanted to ask you about was attorney compensation. Because to me, that is the key to everything. Because without proper attorney compensation, people are going to invest in these training a trial lawyer. It's going to leave them if that person's not happy with what they're getting.
And it is the most common asked question when people ask us about businesses and what law firms and what do y'all do? And because it is always just random questions that email. How do you pay your lawyers? And I tell them we don't pay them at all. They just do it for free. They love it so much. And they don't believe me.
That's like TLU and me. Just do it because I love it. You know, if I scrape a couple dollars here together, pay my rent, I'm happy. But more than that, I don't need it. But really, how do you talk about and think about compensation?
But, you know, at the core of it is, well, the question, and we get asked, and this isn't my quote, but it's, well, what happens if we get these attorneys on board and we train them to be great trial attorneys and we pay for them to go to TLU? And what happens if we do all this stuff and make them great trial attorneys and then they leave? And the better question is, well, what if we don't train them and don't make them great trial attorneys and they stay? Probably worse.
And there's another part to it. A lot of big law firms look at their pay to their lawyers as a percentage and say, well, we're winning because we're paying our lawyers this low percentage. And we look at it a little bit differently. We look at it as not the percentage you're paying the lawyers, but what's the total amount of money that they're producing for the firm after you pay them? Because if you pay somebody 5%, but they only produce $50,000 a year, there's not a lot left over. But if you pay them, let's say somebody paid 50%, they produced $10 million, so they're still putting $5 million in the law firm instead of $40,000. So trying to get that right is a very, very difficult task. And it really is dependent on the lawyers that you have in your firm and the lawyers that you want for your firm.
We do like compensation plans that have some type of percentage of the upside going to the attorney. Some firms, the entire compensation plan is pure commission. And so they make a percentage of everything they bring in that can work well. And then some firms have, hey, the one that doesn't work is here's your salary and I'll do a discretionary bonus at the end of the year. And no one knows what it's based on. That is probably the worst. The ones that seem to work probably the best or some hybrid where there's a salary component plus some percentage of what they bring in. At the end of the day, Steve hit the nail on the head. Some firms will brag, hey, I paid my attorneys X percent. It's a small percent. But then we look at the quality of the attorneys they have and like, okay, well, yeah, you're getting what you pay for and you haven't had any verdicts over and your average fee sucks. And, you know, there's a lot of other things that come along with getting discount attorneys, right?
And that story of paying a salary with a discretionary bonus at the end of the year is exactly why I left the last law firm I was at. Because at the end of the year, they said, oh, we decided we paid you enough this year. So I decided to leave.
That's typically what happens. Doesn't matter what they're getting paid. If they don't think it's fair, it's done. And once somebody feels like they've been treated unfairly, it's kind of hard to go back and like fix things, you know?
Well, the key to it is, and we'll talk about more in California, but the key to it is having controlled expectations where the lawyer knows what they have to do to get to what pay level so that there's not a confusion and the expectation is I'm going to get paid a bunch at the end of the year or I'm not going to get paid a bunch at the end. They want to know. They want to know what the scoreboard is. They want to know, how do I win this game?
Yeah. And so really what we'll do early on is when we work with firms is we'll analyze what we call their labor ratio. What's their total labor divided by revenue? What does that look like? What does their revenue per fee center look like? Why per fee? Sometimes you may have five attorneys at your firm, but only two are producing fees. You might have a research attorney. You might have an intake attorney. You might have someone that helps somebody else. You really need to know, like, well, how many attorneys do we have at our firm that are expected to generate fees, fee centers, right? And that's different. How are they paid? What kind of case counts do they have? How do you balance it? We'd have firms that would brag, hey, I got an attorney with 300 cases. You know, we're so efficient. And well, you can handle 300 cases poorly. And that's not what we're about. We want to have standards for how often we talk to the clients, how quickly we move files, how proactive we are, how much we'll dig into a file to get the best result for the client. And for us, that means lower case counts, and we're okay with that, right? We'll assess all these things to say, hey, you know what? Your comp plan is out of whack, or your comp plan's perfect. It works good. Or the most common thing I probably run into is you have 10 attorneys, you have 10 different comp plans that are totally out of sync and make no sense whatsoever. It's just because, well, this one kind of bitched a little bit more, and this one was cool with it, and this one kind of came in, and da da da. And it's just a mess. Right. And so we're trying to get some consistency to it.
Yeah, because you have to remember that lawyers, in their competitive nature, they never talk about this stuff at the water cooler or at the bar. They just never do. That's pure sarcasm. Okay.
I got the sarcasm. Yeah. And then, okay. So then we're on to, I think when you talk about low hanging fruit to increase your profitability, what are we talking about there?
Yeah. So like when, you know, Steve and I, James will go into a firm and they're saying, how can we be better? How can we, in the assessment piece, believe it or not, we can get a rough idea of how well they execute on this mission statement. The mission statement that we all should have, in my opinion, and that we do, if you were to articulate it, is how do we get the cases with the highest potential to the attorneys with the most skill, experience, and results, and support them with our best resources? As a firm, that's what we're trying to do. And you could actually mathematically measure that to some degree through some of the analysis that we do, right? A lot of firms, their top 5% of their cases generate about 50% of their revenue. Top 20% generates about 80% of their revenue. And how close firms are to those numbers gives some indication at how good they're executing on that mission statement. Firms that don't have attorneys that are taking cases to trial or really pushing litigation, all their cases start to look the same. Their average fee is lower and time on desk is a little bit lower. Firms that do a really good job of saying, hey, you know what? Of these 100 cases, here's the 5 cases that are really our best ones. We're going to get them to the right attorney at the right time in the life of the case. Not that they're going to go hit a home run on every single case, but they're going to have more home runs on average than someone that has not been doing this for a long time or has not gotten to trial lawyers university, learned the skills. But the idea is if we give them enough shots at it, then they're going to get more wax. And so when we go in, low hanging fruit is like, can we find that top 5% and who is handling them and what is their experience, skill, and results?
Just on a side note too, like one of my recent bootcamp attendees mentioned that they were at your accelerator conference. And so I asked them how it was. Oh, he said, you know, and their experience with you guys. And so he said, oh, it was great. Because his average fee went from $10,000 a year to $21,000. And so he gave a lot of attribution to you guys. That's dope, man. Especially you got 5,000 cases. I'm not bright, but I could do the math.
And so often what I'll do, like if you move your average close fee from $10,000 to $21,000, it will transform your firm. And so what I'll do is I have, you know, there's a methodology by which we'll dive into. I'm trying to find about 8%, the best 8% that ultimately ends up being the best 5%. And so I'll overshoot a little bit. I turn them over to Steve and James. I go, look, I don't know. Check these out. And then, you know, they're looking for much more granular stuff on those cases that Steve and James will get into. But Steve, when we pass those over, what are some of the things that you guys are looking for to see, okay, is this case got some potential? Does this case have some upside? Is this something we could do something with?
And I think we're touching on this as at a separate part of the conference in Huntington, which is we look at it, which a lot of the law firms won't do. And there's some people that are experienced that might listen to this podcast and say, we do it. There's probably a lot of people that don't, if they're honest. And that is, what is it that generates the money for cases? And everybody wants to talk to me and say, hey, I got this great plaintiff. She's like Mother Teresa. And I'm like, okay, great. How'd she get hurt? What do you mean? Well, who's the bad guy here? Who is the jury going to say, fuck that dude, right? That's who I'm looking for. And if they haven't identified it, that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. That means they haven't been looking for it, right? They need to go find out who that is, who's the bad guy. And then we can say, okay, now you got the two parts of the equation, which I talked about in the last podcast, which is bad defendant, worthy plaintiff. You take those two and add them up, that's a good case. So we're looking for both because everybody knows that they're good plaintiffs and everybody knows they're bad plaintiffs, right? Everybody knows the one with the warts. Luckily at Dudley DeBossier, we have no cases with any clients that have any problems, no warts whatsoever. That's also sarcasm.
All right, man, it's good that you let us know, because you are really good at being the straight man. Like, Chad, he's got a big grin on his face when he says something sarcastic. You look the same, man. Yeah. I'm like, is he being sarcastic? They have only perfect clients there. It's a good screening process. Chad's really put some good shit in place so you guys could get those cherry-picked case. I like to see it.
They don't exist. But you know, I have a lot of people that say, you're not going to believe this shit, but this shitty client, they had a neck injury back in college 20 years ago. I'm like, oh, we got to dump that case immediately. What are you talking about? My first question is, how did they get hurt? What is it that made their neck injury worse? And they're like, well, I mean, they don't know. They don't know the reason. Or they say things like, it was just a rear end accident. When I hear those words, just a rear end accident, I immediately kind of have a little heart palpitations and say, please don't use those words around me. Somebody crashed in the back of somebody. And then my next question is, why did they do it? Were they looking at their phone? Were they looking at the term I use is, what's the term, Chad?
Steve is so good at uncovering the crazy, insane things other people do when they get into a crash. He assumes the worst case scenario about every defendant driver. And as a result, he finds a lot of good stuff. So I think Steve always assumes they're driving in reverse, wrong way down the road, drunk, high, watching goat porn with a dead body in the trunk. he approaches every deposition assuming, now tell me why you weren't doing any of that.
Yeah, what'd you do with the dead body? Right?
Now prove it. Now where's your proof that he did this? I got it.
And you know, he's had some crazy, crazy things happen. And look, do you find that on every case? No, but you find some wild, wild stuff that defendants do and defendant companies do. And that's where some of these cases really go crazy. So often in the beginning, we're like, hey, look, are there any low-hanging fruit? We'll try and systematically find maybe the top 8% of the cases, get them over Stephen James and Mike, narrow down some that have some opportunity, and then dig in. Do you always find some winners? No, but sometimes you find a case where a firm's about to settle it for $2 million and high five, but it's a $5 million case, and they need to hear that, because sometimes we all have the danger can happen to all of us. You don't talk about your cases and bounce them off other smart, capable attorneys. You get into this vacuum where you're like, you either overvalue your case or undervalue it, both to your client's detriment. And so we're big on talking about cases and roundtabling them.
So what three things, so hour five is increasing your average fee. So it says, what three things can people do to increase their average fee?
The first three things that we start off with is, look, you got to have an honest conversation and assessment of your attorneys. Two, you got to make sure all your cases are ranked appropriately. And then three, round table and push for values on your best cases. So breaking that down, if we're committed to getting the cases with the highest potential to the attorneys with the most skill, experience, and results, we have to know who those are. If we're all in disagreement about who's the quarterback, you know, who's the point guard, then it causes chaos. It causes confusion. We have a tier system of attorneys. And tier one would be someone straight out of law school or new to the practice of personal injury, needs lots of supervision, needs lots of coaching. Tier five would be this person's gotten several multi-million dollar verdicts as a first chair in a jury trial. They're competent at all levels of litigation, et cetera. And like, these are broad categories, but we got to have that conversation, because if you don't, the biggest danger that we run into is that we have maybe a tier two attorney that thinks they're a tier five and tries to hold on to every single case. And rather than having that disagreement over and over and over again, have it once. And if this person is going to be so selfish that they're going to put the client's result in jeopardy because they don't have the self-awareness to say, I'm not the right person for this case, then that, I would argue, that person does not need to be at your firm. And you need to get that conversation out of the way first and foremost. Likewise, if you're wondering why you don't have any $1 million verdicts, or, you know, people say this all the time, we have no great cases. It's not true. Often it's because you have attorneys that are just, they're green. That's it. They haven't had a bunch of trial experience. Maybe they're what we call a tier two or a tier three. They don't know what to look for. They don't know what Steve finds in these cases. They don't know what James sees in these cases because they've never handled one of those hands-on, right? And so you're asking a bunch of people to look for something that they've never really seen. And that gets tough.
And Dan, when you ask the question, what are the three things? Quite frankly, we have 10 things that we can talk to people about. It depends on where you're starting. Because if they're starting at ground zero, that's a different conversation than somebody that's further down the path. And so let me give a plug. This just happened, by the way. I just got this text. Hey, Steve, I heard you on the Trial Lawyer University podcast, which is you. Really inspiring. I was hoping to speak to Chad about getting my firm to the next level. We currently generate $1.5 to $2 million annual revenue, and we want to do 10 times that. And it goes on further, his name and whatnot, who I'll call after. But that's typically the conversations we have. Somebody that's kind of stuck at this level, that they just can't get to the next level, and they're not sure why they can't get to the next level. And so they want to just take a look at it and say, what am I missing? So first of all, thank you, Dan. I got somebody else trying to hire Accelerator, so.
Oh, and like, honestly, I've told a lot of folks about, you know, you guys and what you can help them with. So you might be more popular than you imagine in Huntington Beach. You just never know. You know, I always like to be the most popular person wherever I go. It's just part of my insecurity. So I don't know how you guys are. A lot of people are like, I don't like people bothering me. I like everybody knowing me. I'm like, I'm the opposite. I like everybody know my name.
We're people.
Exactly, right. It's like, this is my sweet spot, is being around people, especially trial lawyers. They make me happy. And so you got to know how good your attorneys are. And then you said you got to figure out.
Yeah, what are you working with? So number one, kind of have that conversation. But hey, where are we as a firm? Like, let's just be realistic. And you know what? When's the last time we tried a case? And what's the last time we got a verdict over $1 million? When's the last time we got a verdict over $5 million? Or just have an honest assessment of the team that you're working with. And can everyone get comfortable with going, hey, look, I may want to be a tier 5, you know, badass attorney one day, but I realize right now I'm a tier 2. And when I get this case that looks like this, this, and this, I need to pass the ball. I need to, you know, get it to the guys, and I'll go help them. I'll go work with them on it, but I'm not there yet. And if you got to have that type of conversation, or else it's kind of chaotic.
New puppy, by the
life of the case. There we go.
Oh, that's so sweet.
So
what a sensitive guy Steve is.
Yes,
I'm telling you, a little puppy, and he's a dad. Wow.
But I think that, you know, the second thing that we look at is, and this is a concept we worked with, you know, just a bunch of firms that were getting really crazy results for their clients and doing some really amazing things. And after sitting with several of them, I noticed that they had one thing in common, was that so many firms rank their cases by saying, okay, you know what, day one, it's worth zero. And they go to the doctor, you know, for 30 days, and now it's gone up a little bit. Now they get an MRI and that comes back positive. Boom. And then, you know what? Now they're going to do page man and goes up again. Okay. You know what? Now their surgery can. It goes from zero or the bottom and it starts going up. The guys who were getting some great results looked at cases differently. They go, how much coverage do we have? Now tell me why my case isn't worth that. Like, it's a different mindset and going, I'm going to assume this is a great case until I know otherwise, not that it's starting from zero and up. And so we built this case ranking system that's designed with that in mind and identifying the cases where there's the highest potential early on at specific intervals in the case and revisiting it on a consistent basis. And so that it's designed to find the best cases, give them the right people. Then the third thing is we call it the evaluation committee. We say, okay, there's firms that their best 5% of their cases look a little bit different, but most firms, it's around cases that are 250,000 or more in gross settlement, tend to make up about 5 to 8% of their cases, tends to generate about 50% of their revenue. We want to be pushing for maximum value on each and every one of these cases. And we don't want anyone settling or negotiating those cases in a vacuum. And so what we do is we do this thing called the valuation committee, where when a demand goes out on a case that meets that criteria, there's a way that we roundtable it. And it's not a democracy. It's who has the highest level of credible risk tolerance. What does that mean? Well, you know, if I present a case and I go, hey, I think it's worth, you know, $250,000, and Dan goes, I think it's worth $50 million, and he's never tried a case or he's never been, you know, to trial, that's not credible risk tolerance. Now, if Steve just tried a case and he said, hey, look, I know this case and I just got, you know, 3 verdicts and da-da-da-da, and he says, I think it's worth $2 million, not $500,000, Chad. Well, he's got the highest level of risk tolerance, and we really need to pay attention to what he's saying. And we want to bring everyone up to that level at the firm, not people settling the same case for different amounts, which is incredibly inefficient. And so we're going to talk about those three things and how do you go implement that? Because we've had firms where they hear this and they're like, okay, that sounds great. And then next week they go and it's just chaos. There's a very organized way to do this. And we've learned some things, Steve. I know when we present in the valuation committee, some of the best practices, Steve and James have had a big role in kind of framing how that happens. You know, we don't use the word accident. We don't talk badly about our plaintiff.
Yeah. If anybody gets in that meeting and the first thing they say is, let me tell you about this piece of shit I represent, you're out. Right. So there's some rules. But the other thing is that we have a lot of people from a lot of other firms present in our evaluation committee, which, by the way, is 2 o'clock on Wednesday Central Standard Time. If you got a case, you want to just present it to our group, which is usually about 7 or 8 people on the call. We're not charging anybody to do that. We love it. Just tell us about your case and we'll say we think it's worth X or we don't. Or when we do that, probably we have the meeting every Wednesday, probably half to maybe a third of those meetings have somebody else from another law firm coming in and presenting their case. Sometimes I learn great stuff, so I'm very excited about it. Sometimes we look at cases and go, I think you missed the boat on this one. You're way undervaluing it. But it's the lawyer that takes his pride and puts it aside and wants the best result, not to talk about how great they are. If somebody's willing to do that, because we've had a lot of our own lawyers say our process, the committee, they call it the gauntlet. Oh, shit, we got to go to the gauntlet with this case. But our answer is, would you rather go to people that care and love about you than 12 people that don't give a shit about you? Let's go and find the problems first, then we'll go to 12 people that don't care.
Even though I don't have my own practice and everything, if possible, I'd like to sit in an evaluation committee because I like to see how things work. And I see a lot of cases, you know, doing this. And some of them are like, wow. And some of them like, ooh, you know, you get a wrongful death verdict of $1 million. I'm thinking like, where do you live that people are so callous about human life? But I mean, there's a lot of variables that go into it. It could be in LA, just be in a shitty place in the valley in Van Nuys or somewhere where they got, you know, judges that are more difficult and jurors that are less generous, we'll call them that. So it's just always this crapshoot.
This defense lawyer told me I'm trying a case in Massachusetts in 30 days. And he said, I don't think you understand the value of cases in Massachusetts. I said, oh, you must not have Americans there in Massachusetts. What do you mean? I said, well, why do you think your Americans are different than the Americans anywhere else?
You know, CVN broadcasts in Massachusetts, so you might want to check with them to see if they want to broadcast it. I'm just suggesting, you know, if you got a trial, you might as well broadcast it if you think you're going to do a good job. It's, you know, it's good for people to learn and watch. Just a suggestion for the community, but just do with it what you want. So the last hour on the first day, you're going to talk about 10 reports.
Yeah. And this is where, you know, it's been so awesome to work with Steve and James because we're constantly going, we'll come up with a system or process and go, is this going to work? You know, is it, how do we keep track of this? How are we going to implement it? Maybe, for example, Steve or James, we went to TLU and here's a really great stuff that we want to add into how we take defendant driver depositions, right? All right. Then my brain goes, well, how do we systematize that for 50 plus attorneys? How do we create reports that allow us to have visibility as to whether or not they're doing it. And there's parts of it that you can systematize, the science of it. At the end of the day, how that attorney executes on that defendant driver deposition, how they pull it off is the art of it, but we've got to set them up for success. And so we'll have this kind of conversations to answer your question. Those reports are like, hey, look, here's some key reports that you need to make sure your firm is running smoothly. Will they solve everything? No, but they'll get you pretty far down the road to running a great firm.
When we got to 200 total team members, Chad gave me a gift and he called me and he said, hey, we just got to 200 people. What are the chances of everybody doing the right thing at every minute? And I hung up on him. It is important to realize if you don't have a way to know what's going on, to track them, to have some system in place to figure out what people are doing, to make sure they have the tools to do the right thing, the chances of them doing the right thing really go down dramatically. So we want to know, it's not that we're checking up on people. We're not putting cameras in people's desks and things like that I've seen. It's just show us your work. Show us that you're doing what we want you to do because it matters. Because our system is we're going to do the very best thing for the people we're lucky enough to represent. And everybody needs to do that. And if you're not doing it and we're not following you, then you got to go find some other place to work.
Makes sense. So, because people can sign up for one day or both days of your program. So the second day, you're going to start off with the core discipline, 3 simple disciplines that make a big difference. What are those 3 disciplines, Chad or Steve?
Look, those disciplines, like how you communicate with your clients, how disciplined are you about talking to them in very systematic, intentional, purposeful ways? How do you often do you touch the file? What do you do when you pick up the file? And are you disciplined about taking action to move it closer to resolution, to a trial date, or adding value to the case? You know, can you be intentional? Those things. And then how are you coaching your attorneys on a consistent basis? How are you giving them feedback? How are you making them better systematically? Again, great thing about TLU, right? You can get their skill sets improved, but there's ways to do it. So those 3 disciplines, what we call client communication, file reviews, and then coaching reviews, to help firms be better.
And if you don't have those simple things systematized, it's not happening. And, you know, just the simplest things. We start off by saying you got to call your clients every 30 days. And then we'd go back and look at it. And some people would call them and say, hey, Dan, how's your mom and them? And Dan would say, oh, they're doing fine. Okay, well, nice seeing you. I'll talk to you in 30 days. Fucking worthless. So, yeah, I talked to them, but I didn't talk to them about how to make their case better or what's going on with their life to make the case better.
Where are they still having pain? Who's the last doctor they saw? What date? When's the next doctor they're going to see? What date? What were they going to do? Like, intentional communication. That's different. Yeah.
All right. So now we're on to big case file review. This sounds exciting.
When you got your best cases, your biggest cases, how are you picking them apart? And can you be disciplined about how you do it, right? And so we have a checklist of things that when Steve and James get together with attorneys on their best cases, what are they looking for? What are they going through? It's different than just saying, hey, let's go shoot the shit about your best case with no form, function. There's a time for that. There's a time that can be fruitful. But we want to be intentional when we go through these reviews of our biggest and best cases, making sure that we're getting the best value possible.
And is there like a threshold? Because for every lawyer, a big case is going to be different. A lot of lawyers, $100,000 policy is going to be like, whoa, hit the jackpot on this one. Everybody, I'm focused on this one case for the next 2 months. Nobody talk to me. And some people, it might be $50 million, depending on.
It's a great question. And that's why in the assessment, we determine what is your top 5% look like, right? I said for most firms, it's cases that are worth $250 or more. With us, we'll you know, absolutely do a big case review on cases that have the potential being worth $1 million or more. Some firms, that's what their top 5% looks like. Other firms, their top 5% might look like cases that are $100,000 or more. You'd be surprised, but there's a way to assess it at the beginning and say, okay, cases that look like this, you should run through this system.
Because if the math is pretty simple, if you take the cases that produce 50% of your fees in a given year and you increase those cases by 50%, well, that's a big deal to a law firm versus increasing the bottom 50%. You're not moving the needle. You've done nothing. Bless you, Dan.
Bless you. Bless you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'd say that's pretty impressive that you were able to mic yourself that quickly.
It takes practice. This is my second podcast of the day. So I'm starting to get my groove. This podcasting, you know, it takes some time to get, you know, just like webinars. It took me some time at the beginning of the pandemic. People to send me these hate mails. I like your webinar. I like the content, but you talk too fucking much. I'm like, of course, it was hurtful at the beginning and I had my own response. But as I was able to mature and take it in, I realized I didn't need to be the center of everything. I'm the youngest of 8 kids, though. So a lot of it's not my fault. It's predisposed to be a seeker of attention. I can't help it, but it's life. But, you know, with this masterclass, you guys are going to do a couple Zoom meetups, hope, you know, as many as you'd like, but at least a couple. And so what kind of information are you going to want people to get together and gather up and learn about their firms before they come? Because you guys are helping them, everybody, do a deep assessment of where they're at, what they're doing.
Yeah. If you want to get the most out of your firm, bring your last 2 years of P&Ls, profit and loss statements. Not that we got to dig into yours, but we can run you through exercise. Look at your own data. We can help you a lot just off those two things, right? The 2 years of those, I think that will help. If you know your average close fee, that's great. But if you come in and we're walking through some very practical exercises so that you can go back and apply these concepts to your firm.
All right. Depositions. Because part of this is going to be on depositions, which is kind of unusual because depositions is more of a practice thing than it is a financial performance vehicle. So how did depositions, out of all the pieces of the trial, get so lucky to find itself in your agenda?
Well, this goes back to, you know, Steve and I having conversations about, you know what, we spent some time, how do we get better at depositions? They come up with some concepts. We go, okay, that's great, but how do we apply it to 50 attorneys? We're going to go through kind of both. How do we interact, like Steve, James, getting nitty gritty on the strategies for certain depositions, but in the bulk, if we're taking a bunch of depositions each week, how do we know everyone's prepared? How do we know which one Steve or James should dive into with our other lit coaches? And it gets exponentially more complex the more cases that you're handling. And so we'll share how we attack that as a firm.
And in fairness, I mean, I've been trained by Don Keenan and Roger Dodd and a bunch of other great lawyers. And so we take those same people and expose our lawyers to those guys. I think Roger Dodd's probably done his two-day seminar, it's more of a boot camp, with maybe 30 of our lawyers, maybe even more than that. And so we're very intentional about making sure they know what they're doing, because me and James, and we have 5 lit coaches that are 5 of our best lawyers, they can't be in every deposition, but they got to have a comfort level that the lawyer handling the deposition knows what they're doing going in.
So you said a lit coach. Tell me more. I've never heard of this concept of a lit coach. So
our firm is broken up right now. If you just take Dudley DeBossier proper, remove all the other firms we're coaching, other firms we have a ownership interest, just Dudley DeBossier proper. We right now, I think we're between 50 and 55 lawyers. And of those top five lawyers, each have a 10 or 11 people on their team. And so those five lawyers, I work with those guys and James works with those guys. And then they go down and they handle the next tier of lawyers. So they'll have meetings every month with everybody on their team. And then what they're doing is two things. They're making sure that they know what the younger lawyers know what they're doing. And they're also trying to identify the best cases to make sure that they have the right eyeballs on it. We don't handle any case after a certain level, after $250,000 with one lawyer. There's always multiple lawyers on that case because one lawyer can't do it well. Every lawyer thinks they can do it well because, you know, there's another part of that, right? They don't want to split fees. All right, so they're trying to do it all on their own, which we don't allow them to do it. That took a little bit of a fight. You know, as I spoke at one conference, somebody said, do you have any problems with lawyers and fee splits? I said, never. Why would I?
Sarcasm again, right?
If you take three lawyers and you ask them individually what percentage they played in that case, the number is always the same. It adds up to 270%. Unfortunately, there's only 100%, right? So
I hear you. Well, next we'll be talking about culture, team, and execution. That's always hard to get a good culture because you're dealing with lawyers and everybody's got a massive ego and nobody wants to, you know.
Yeah, so the afternoon session for the second day, we're talking about, you know, culture and talking about, you know, if you are not the same page in terms of culture, it's so hard to execute on these things. Very early in our firm stage, Steve, James, and I said, this is the kind of firm that we're going to be. We're going to be a lit firm. We're going to do great client service. We had guys that did not want to call their clients. We had guys that didn't want to show up to the office till after 10 a.m. We had guys that didn't want to put in the work to become great trial attorneys. And we had to go, this is not the culture we want to create. And they're out of there, right? You can't create a great firm with people that want to be mediocre. You know, so we're going to focus on some of that and then also talking about, well, you know, we got to touch on some of the marketing pieces of it because that goes back to what kind of firm that you're trying to create. If you're trying to get cases from other law firms, well, that's a different marketing strategy that firms are like, you know what, I'm going to go buy leads or I'm going to go advertise on billboards or TV. I'm going to refer cases out. I'm going to, you know, only keep a certain number of cases. There's so many different strategies that you can use to market, but you got to find the one that jives with the firm that you're trying to be. You can't get a bunch of cases from other firms if you only have tier two attorneys, right? They want to send cases to tier five attorneys and people that know what they're doing. So we're gonna talk about those things toward the end of day two and then also have a question and answer session that usually after 2 days of that kind of stuff, there's usually lots of questions and we're going to be there and be available to do whatever we can to help all the attendees make their firm great.
That's awesome because everybody wants to run a better operation because then you can be better trial lawyers. You can do more justice and make more money. Not that people really care about the money, but we do need money in order to build the dojos and be able to get the justice that people need. So I appreciate you guys taking the time to stop by today here. I really look forward to Huntington Beach. I know you guys have never been to TLU before. I'm working extra hard to make this one awesome.
We're looking forward to it. We can't wait to meet everybody and have two great days of how to, you know, make the firm awesome.
Thanks, guys.
We are an open book. I mean, Chad said that earlier. Our biggest competitor in Louisiana, we sent our managing lawyer to his firm to tell him everything that we do. And that's, we are absolutely an open book. So anybody that's got any questions about how we do it, it's not a big secret. You know, the question is, are they willing to do it? We're an open book of how we do it.
Great, because that's what people need is help and community. And so that's what we're going to provide them in Huntington Beach in about 71 days. All right, guys, take care.
Don't forget about getting that pickleball, Dan.
Ready to train with the Titans and set records with your verdicts? Register for our live conferences and boot camps at triallawyersuniversity.com. Start getting your reps in before the big event by going to tluondemand.com to gain instant access to live lectures, case analysis, and skills training videos from the trial lawyer champions you love and respect, as well as pleadings, transcripts, PowerPoints, and notes for a roadmap to victory. Join the group that continues to get extraordinary results. Trial Lawyers University. produced and powered by LawPods.